Okay, so the topic today is evil. We're going to have an evil topic. Or as Mae West once said, which I love this quote, "When choosing between two evils, I always like to try the one I've never tried before." Yeah. In terms of the agenda today, I want to cover, if we have enough time, the Kabbalistic view of evil, because I think that Kabbalah has a very interesting twist on it, and Judaism in general. How much a part of human nature evil is, like, are we evil? Is a person potentially evil? By default evil? Then why does religion seem to be the source of so much evil in the world? And finally, a response to evil, or as much as we have time to cover of those. So first we start with Kabbalah, and this Sunday is Lag BaOmer, and it is the yahrzeit of the author of the Zohar. So we'll start with a piece of Zohar. And the Zohar tells, it's a very famous parable, this king who wanted to test his son, because he was ready to give his son, the prince, more added responsibilities, but he wanted to test him to see if he was intrinsically a good, decent person, human being, or if it was just that he found himself in the milieu of the palace and everybody is so sophisticated in the palace and there's art and there's, so obviously you're surrounded by that elevated reality, you become elevated. Or is there really something there? So he engages a temptress, a harlot, to try and entice the prince and to distract the prince. Now, the psychology of this temptress is fascinating, because let's try and analyze her. She's been given a job by her king to do, and that job is to entice the king's son. Now, she understands what the king wants to accomplish, and that truly the king only wants the child to, he wants his son to have the resistance, the strength to not succumb to her wiles. On the other hand, she can't do an inadequate job, because that would be treason. She has to employ every single tool that she has at her disposal in order to get the prince to succumb. But secretly, she really hopes that he doesn't, because she understands that's what her beloved king really wants. And she is a loyal citizen of the king. So she tries her best, but she hopes that she fails, because she knows that would be the ultimate outcome of the king. And that is the description of evil given by the Tzar. So the Tzar says that evil, the king of obviously is God. By the way, Kabbalah is always employing the analogies of kings, because it's a very valuable analogy to be able to understand, for us to have an inkling of something of the power of our Creator. So the king is God, the prince is the Jewish people or mankind, and the temptress are the forces of evil. So according to that model that the Tzar proposes, evil is really not a separate entity like other religions believe, Christianity for example, that there's some kind of, there was a falling out and a great angel, you know, became the Satan, and now they're having this huge battle over history. And they're like equals having a battle, so, you know, two countries at war with each other. Judaism sees evil as a creation of God, like any other creation, totally subservient to God, doing His will, which is to tempt us, for whatever reason, and hoping all the time that God's true desire will be fulfilled, and that is that we will resist the temptation. Now, the reason that the Zohar tells us that is probably because it gives us a clue to defeating evil. If you understand that evil is not some ferocious entity that's against you and going to destroy you, then you have, and really it's on your side, in other words, it wants to fail, you could use that potentially to, in your battle, in our battle against evil, knowing that it's only a creation of God and it really wants to fail. All right, let's go further back, or let's go to the beginning. And the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
It's not a perfect model, though, but if you would say that the point of the temptress was just to see if you would fail or not, and she got nothing out of it herself.
The point of the temptress,
you could say,
that is that
she doesn't really care. She just, there's no benefit to her if he fails or succeeds.
Correct. As there's no benefit to evil if we fail and succumb to evil or succeed. There's no benefit. Evil has a job to do, and it's a 9-to-5 job. It does its job, and that's it. It quits. It doesn't care about the outcome.
The job is to just tempt you, actually to make you achieve a negative result.
It's no, it is a big difference. That is the difference. That's the difference I want to illustrate. The Satan's job is to tempt you, not to make you sin.
It's not paid a commission.
So it's not paid a commission if you succumb or not. It only no commission.
I'm not a perfect Moshe, because you're magical. You don't know the arrangement she had with the king, but it doesn't have to be the. It could be I paid for delivery as opposed to you failed.
No, he didn't. He paid her to tempt her, and because he brought her in on his confidence. He said, look, here's the prince. I want to strengthen the prince.
So he told her that.
Yes.
She knew it all along.
She knows everything. She is a spiritual creation of God, who is and knows everything that she knows all the rules of the game. All right, back to the tree of knowledge. The tree of knowledge in the story of Adam and Eve, they were given one commandment, they were not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That's actually the first time in the Torah where the word evil is used. Up till then, the word good has appeared a few times, but the tree of knowledge, Eitz Hadas, Tov V'ra, good and evil, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that's the first time the word evil is used in the Torah.
The 33rd word in the Torah is Tov.
Everyone?
The 32nd or 33rd word, I think it's 32nd word, Tov.
Letter.
No, word in the Torah.
Yeah.
Tov.
Every day except...
No, 32nd letter.
Letter, right, that's it.
Oh, sorry, word, not word, 32nd word. Racist brought against the man. What's it, the year, but you're tired.
Yeah.
It's the 32nd word.
32nd?
For Mike Bomer.
Mike Bomer, yes. But we're focusing on evil today. Not good. Not good to focus on good today. So the tree of knowledge is so what was it? You know, somebody told me recently a beautiful phrase which I like. They said, we approach the Torah like a lullaby. What's a lullaby? Well, you know, everyone knows the lullaby, rockabye baby on the treetop, right? And how many millions and millions of parents have sung that to their children, their young, innocent, beautiful, angelic children, whilst putting them to sleep, they've been singing that song, you know, rockabye baby. And we all sing it and we all know the words and nobody thinks about it. But if you would think about it, it's horrific. Rockabye baby on the treetop. So first of all, who puts a baby in a cradle on a treetop? I mean, that is abusive. I mean, that could get you in big trouble. Besides the fact that where's the morality in it? What did a child do that you put them in such a precarious and dangerous situation? And then the cradle rocks and everybody comes falling down. The baby, what a violent image. And this is how you're putting your child to sleep. It's like the more you think about that lullaby, the more absurd it becomes and the more difficulty you have with it. So there's a whole bunch of stories in the Chumash, and we know these stories from our youngest age, and we all can tell them, and we do tell them to our children and everything, and every story in the Chumash, practically, if not every, without exception, has a so-called elephant in the room, has something that is a fundamentally problematic issue in this story. But because we lullaby it and we just say it and we don't stop to think, but there's some very profound issues going on here, like with this, and especially with the tree of knowledge. I mean, what was the tree of knowledge? You know, these role-playing games that people play on the internet. So every now and then you hear that some guy figured out a hack. You know, if you kick a wall three times like this, and then jump up twice and type in a certain word or whatever, you find a way in to the game, and then you can manipulate the game to your advantage. But then, of course, everybody, you know, so there's teams of programmers who they're trying to stop these hackers from coming in and patch up any holes in the code or any bugs that will allow them to exploit that weakness, right? So Hashem built a universe, a game, a role-playing game, if you will, and he said to all the players, here's the hack. And he like distributed the source code for the hack of the game. Like he showed, you know, no role-playing game has arrows pointing, you know, do this, instructions on how to crack the code. So the Torah tells us that Hashem put the tree of knowledge in the middle of the garden. It's like, and then he comes and he says, don't touch that. That's the one you shouldn't touch. Like, I mean, he's setting us up to hack the system. What's going on over here? And then why does he get so nervous if they eat? They're going to be like one of, now that he's eaten, he's like one of us, he's become godly. So should he eat from the tree of life? He'll live forever, and now death has come into the world, and before there wasn't death. And I mean, is God so insecure in his position over there that he comes? You know, once you just start thinking a little bit about this story, something that every child knows, all of a sudden becomes very difficult. So again, let's look at the Zohar to give us a little clue to making some sense of the story. That's not my primary focus today, but there's a very interesting point that I want to illustrate. And that is as follows. When we have the tree of knowledge, Eitz Hadaat, Tov V'Ra, tree of knowledge of good and evil, what does that mean? Prior to Adam and Eve sinning, they were naked, but they weren't ashamed. After they were sinned, they all of a sudden became ashamed. So prior to them sinning, they weren't ashamed because good and evil were apparent. There was good. Good was, the Torah itself says, all the fruits of the garden were good.
Everything was good.
Bad was the tree of knowledge. They weren't allowed to eat from the tree of knowledge. That was the one commandment, negative commandment they were given. Well, if you define bad as being not following God's will, so that God only gave them one commandment. Correct. The tree itself wasn't bad, but the concept of evil was the negative. Okay. So here you have the Garden of Eden, and Adam and Eve are in it, and everything is crystal clear, black and white. Evil is bad, is well defined. Good is well defined, and it's all external. It's a tree out there. When they ate, they internalized evil, and from that point on, they became a composite of good and evil. There was no more black and white. Everything became gray. So anything, you know, money. There's a religion that says money is the root of all evil. I think that's inaccurate. I think money is neutral. You give a lot of money to a guy like Bill Gates, and he uses it to vaccinate the whole of Africa and other, you know, build libraries in every city. So he does good. You give the same millions to Osama bin Laden, and he uses it to destroy lives and to create death and mayhem everywhere he goes. So is the money good or bad? It's a composite, and you can extract what's good out of it. You can extract what's bad out of it. There's a very interesting discussion.
It's not the money that's good, it's the usage of it.
Correct.
Different again. So the money itself is neither good nor bad.
Nor is the usage of the money good or bad.
Well, it can be.
It's the usage.
I'm saying the usage,
yeah,
that's right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right. Correct. There is nothing in this world that is good or bad. I mean, I could give you, you know, a knife in a kitchen drawer is morally neutral. if you use that knife, again, it comes down to usage, to prepare food for hungry people, that's a good thing. If a child gets hold of the knife, that would be a negative
nothing
thing.
Without a choice.
What's that?
Nothing without a choice is either good or bad. It's just any intimate.
Correct. Way. There is no good or bad, and there is nothing that is purely good or bad. No human being is purely good or bad, and no, like, I'll give you an example. There's a famous incident where the Chachamim, the sages, they prayed that Hashem remove all sexual desire from all human beings and animals in the world. Because they looked at the world and they saw that our sexual drive is the source of a lot of evil. Rape, adultery, breaking up families, pedophilia, all these stem from an uncontrollable lust that a person has. So they prayed that God remove this temptation from us. And they were successful. God listened and removed all sexual desire from the world. Yeah. So the next morning, when the sages sat down to breakfast, nobody had eggs. And no woman had conceived a child the night before. And so the sages realized that without sexual desire, the world was unsustainable. So they prayed to God to return the desire, but in a limited form. And God did that, and, you know, here we are. So with all its negative baggage, sexual desire also is a force for continuity and good in the world. So like anything you want to take, any urge, any physical object, any human being is a composite of, since the tree of knowledge is now no longer black and white, but is a composite. A beautiful practical teaching that you can take from that idea is that you don't reject anything outright. Because there's nothing that is purely evil anymore that doesn't have some redeeming aspect to it, and there's no, so if you see a human being that's very ugly and his behavior is not befitting, don't write him off. There's some good in that person. And conversely, don't be fooled if a person looks purely good. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. So, how much of human nature is evil?
Sorry, would you say the same thing about concepts as well? Or just objects and...
Concepts as well, absolutely.
There are concepts that are purely good and purely bad.
I haven't come across any.
I know the Rambam, he says, like, the shows the half, so you should golden line with almost everything, but then he outlines things that
anger and arrogance.
And then there would be other concepts.
Let's take
evil like Amalek and things like that, which you could say is a concept of evil.
Yeah. Well, let's take anger because that's a good example. So you're right.
Emotion, concept.
Well, the emotion of anger. Well, that's what was the example that
Ariel said. Vaccinate the world from polio.
Yeah.
If that's a pretty worthy cause, you wouldn't say there's some element of evil in there.
Yes, I would. There are many elements of evil. In fact, I don't vaccinate my children. Because there's
certain... There's ego involved and other things.
I want a safe vaccination.
What's that?
I want to safely vaccinate the world.
There's too many... In any science... You know, there are science... You know... People steeped in science that say that vaccinations are not really effective in preventing disease.
But I want to design one. My ideal is to create a safe vaccination to rid the world.
My ideal is to have a messianic era, but that's beautiful. But Stalin's idea was also to have a utopian state, and that turned out to be a very evil idea.
I don't say it's easy to implement, but say conceptually you can have a good idea.
Post tree of knowledge, mixture of good and evil, you can have, I'll grant you this, there are certain ideas or concepts or things or people that are predominantly good or predominantly bad. It's just not exclusively. That's where I'm drawing the line. There's no 100% here. You know, there could be something overwhelmingly good and positive, and there are many things like that, but that doesn't mean that if you didn't want to and you did dig deep enough, you wouldn't find a kernel of negativity there.
I suppose that terror is excluded from it.
No, I say Torah.
No, Torah. The Gemara says that Torah could be zacha in zacha nasa samachaim if a person merits it's an elixir of life, and if not, God forbid, it's a poison. So Torah itself could be used as an instrument for arrogance.
Yeah, it's an instrument, but not in itself in its purest form. Of course, you can manipulate it anything you like.
Correct. Well, yes, there is still absolute good in the world, and there's still absolute bad. The thing that the Tree of Knowledge did is in this reality of this world, it mixed all those together, so it's hard for us to differentiate
100%
between them.
But conceptually, you can still have a purely good idea.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. But in reality, in the world, it doesn't work, as history has recently proven, because of the reality of the world. That's exactly it. So which is a good segue into the next brief discussion I wanted to have. Are humans, by definition, really like evil and we have to learn how to be good, or are we basically good and we teach ourselves how to be evil? And, of course, this again is a very...
Third option, neither.
Or neither. Third option. So this is one of the classic debates in philosophy and in religion, and the non-Jewish concept of original sin states that we are intrinsically bad, condemned to the eternal barbecue,
because of the Eitzadas.
Because of the Eitzadas, exactly. That is the source of it. The original sin. Unless you do something that will alter your course, you are inherently sinful and, you know, beyond redemption unless you accept religion X, Y, or Z. So that is that concept, and many, many people in the world believe it. Judaism, I think, rejects that concept. The Gemara says that Kol Yisrael Yeshem Chelek Lel Mabo, every Jew has intrinsically a portion of the world to come. We are intrinsically good and deserving of that reward, and you have to do something to mess up that reward. Children are born absolutely pure, and then they mess up. Now, that doesn't mean that if you leave a person, you know, if you just leave a person on the desert island, that he's going to naturally gravitate towards good. It's more like a garden that, you know, starts off pristine and beautiful and well-kept and well-ordered garden with everything in its place. If you say, well, it's a perfect garden and you just leave it at that, it will quickly grow into chaos. You have to constantly maintain the garden, and it's the same with human beings. Just because we believe that you are born pure and you have a pure soul, that doesn't mean that you can rest on that premise. You have to maintain it. All right, so let's just jump quickly into why does religion seem to be the source of so much evil. Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize winner. He won Nobel Prize in chemistry, which of course makes him an expert on religion. As most Nobel Prize winners become experts in politics and religion and everything else, even if it's nothing to do with their field. But anyway, he said the following. He said, religion is an insult to human dignity. With or without it, you'd have good people doing good things and evil people doing bad things. But for good people to do bad things, it takes religion. Okay, and a lot of people, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, these famous atheists, have written extensively about how much evil, especially in the post 9/11 world, how religion seems to be behind so much suffering and pain and evil in the world. From the Spanish Inquisition to the Crusades to long before 9/11, but post 9/11 world, they've really
they trace all the bad in the world to religion.
All the bad in the world to religion. And they say that the world would be much better off with no religion. As Weinberg said, you know, good people wouldn't do bad things if it wasn't for religion, so we should get rid of it. So, what's that?
John Lennon.
John Lennon, Imagine, exactly. So his whole song, Imagine, is exactly that. Imagine what a world would be like without religion, and how much more peaceful and loving and wonderful it would be. So, I go back to the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Everything has a mixture of good and bad. So if you look at something like religion, it has certain good points in it, and has a dark side too, like everything in this world. And you could emphasize and show the dark side, but you could also show the good. Look, if you distill religion down to its bare, like its essence, I would say almost every religion at its core has two fundamental ideas. The one is that there's some kind of, you know, divine force or higher power that did or did not create the world, but there's a higher power. And the second idea is accountability, that you are going to be accountable to that higher power. It's all-knowing, it's all-seeing, there's an afterlife, and if you don't get zapped in this world, you're going to get in the next world. So there's something to be said for, there's some accountability. How could that be a source of evil? On the contrary, it should be something that should prevent the person. So let's say you have a borderline, somebody on the borderline is, you know, is about to commit, like he's a murderer, potentially he's a murderer. That's who he is. Nature, nurture, not getting into that now. The guy's almost about to commit murder. And he finds religion. And so he ends up being just a wife beater. That's all. Not a murderer. Now, you could never know that he would have been a murderer and religion brought him back. You'll only say, look at that religious guy beats his wife. In other words, you know, if a murderer came from a very good home with loving parents, supportive community, everything, and he went out and became a serial killer, okay? So nobody says it's the loving home that created the serial killer. It's in spite of the loving home the serial killer was created. And if so perhaps had that serial killer not had that loving input, he could have been worse, who knows? Maybe yes, maybe no, but there's no connection between the two. If anything, the connection is that the loving family kept him more in check and reined in. So therefore, I would say that religion is not intrinsically evil, as Christopher Hitchens would have us believe, or intrinsically good. It's like everything a mixture, and sometimes people perpetrate evil crimes in the name of religion, but you could argue that worse than religion is human logic, because after all, wasn't it human logic that built gas chambers and tortured concentration camps, torture chambers, killing fields, gunpowder? It's human ingenuity that comes up with the landmines and all these terrible things.
Back to the quote, well, one that says, it's still that bad people doing bad things is their religion. Religion just gives you the excuse for good people doing bad things.
Yeah, but without intelligence, nobody would be able to, without human intelligence, yeah. Nobody would be able to build a concentration camp.
Yeah.
So then we should condemn human intelligence. No, it's stupid, because human intelligence
There's bad people do wrong things. No one's saying
correct.
That religion, everyone's going to be sympathetic and never do anything bad.
Correct. I could make a cogent argument that it is effective, that it does have some benefit in reining in people, that it does do something. But certainly, I don't think it's...
The counterbalance is, it may be good and effective for some people, but provides an excuse for a lot of other people to do a lot worse things.
They would have done it anyway. They just employed their... it was convenient that religion was there and do it, but these were evil people that would have perpetrated evil anyway.
If you don't believe my religion, you'll have Missa.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe if you don't, in some of the concepts say, if you don't dress like I dress, you're not wearing blue shirt, so I'm wearing blue shirt, I'm going to kill you. Mm. No one gets that caught up about these exciting things. Unless it's only religion. Well, gives them the outlet to say, you know, I'll tuck
up. There were secular...
caught up about land rights or...
You're not going to kill you for that. Motivate somebody.
Stalin was anti-religious, and he killed 50 million people. Pol Pot was secularist, he killed. Hitler was a rejected religion in Mein Kampf.
But no one's saying these people are good people. That's the point.
Correct. And there are good people that will, bad people, evil people, who will employ and use the tool of religion to further their evil, nefarious aims.
It's like a middle-range person is not going to kill people anyway, and not a guy who's going to sit there...
Who becomes... let's talk about a Valtshuva. Let's talk about somebody who's...
Where would he go if he doesn't get...
Yeah, so let's talk about somebody who's lived his whole life...
Perfecting what's better or worse.
the guy lived his whole life, he hasn't been religious, he's now in the middle of his life, and he decides he wants to be religious. So he finds religion and he becomes religious. And his family say, you know, he's become more peaceful as a result, he's more generous with his money, he's more, you know, whatever it is that he found in religion brought him some kind of peace and tranquility. So that is probably more, this is impossible to quantify, but certainly it's not an illogical argument to say that people who bring in religion at some point in their lives, into their lives, improve on a most basic, fundamental human level, improve who they are.
It's not about honorable non-members, but honorable barbarity. You could say some person who was a normal person before, well-adjusted, all of a sudden becomes an extremist. Yeah. He might think he's a much better person in his relationship with God, his relationship to other people is much worse.
Right.
So you would say, I am a better person because I've got a straight line to Hashem and I don't give stuff about anybody else.
Correct.
And I'll say, that's the very reason you're a worse person.
Exactly.
So
we did have a world before religion. Simply look at that.
We had a world
before religion.
Yeah.
So, as in religion only came, you can say, with Abraham or later.
So no, that was no desire before then. Definitely no desire.
Terrible. No, but different to, that was more, it was less organized, if you like. Organized religion is I think what they were referring to there.
Titians and them. Yeah,
yeah, they're referring to an organized religion. So paganism wasn't as organized.
Well, they were pretty serious back then, what they did. The Bible and Torah talks about all these religions, what they used to child sacrifice and everything.
That's true.
And everything. He's talking about institutionalized religion, of course.
Yeah.
Which is crap, but...
Yeah, they had institutions as well, I guess, over there.
Of course they did. And whole hierarchy.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. The Egyptians had a very sophisticated religious outlook, one which at our birth we categorically rejected. Yeah. So, very briefly in conclusion, one other thing that...
The answer is religion is just like money, like everything else.
In a world of...
It's how you use it.
Exactly.
It's all you use it. So
absolutely.
There's nothing...
Absolutely. So that's the answer.
Possible.
Yeah.
Yes, and maybe you can't say no, it's not that you
yes.
use it, but
it's yes,
it's
when it's used as a tool for evil, it's very evil. And, you know, the more powerful something is, when you split an atom, you release a tremendous amount of power. That power can destroy a whole city. It can also provide light and warmth to a whole city. It's, the more powerful something is, the human mind is very powerful. Therefore, it's created so much incredible good in this world and also so much incredible evil. The more powerful something is, so if religion as a force is and has been historically a very powerful force and therefore creates incredible good in this world and incredible bad. But because it does create incredible bad, that is not a reason to reject it. Okay. Just to end, one last thing on the Kabbalistic view of evil. Evil is not an entity, as far as Kabbalah is concerned. It's the absence of light. That's very interesting. So you don't battle evil by taking a gun and shooting it, or sweeping it out of a room with a broom. You battle evil by turning on a light. And as soon as you turn on a light, even in a very dark room, all of the darkness disappears instantaneously. Because evil is not an entity, it's an illusion. And the illusion, our efforts mustn't be in battling evil, necessarily, because...
It's not an illusion, it's an anti-solution.
It is an illusion. You know the story of Abraham when he went to sacrifice Yitzchak, and he was traveling, and it says that the Medrash says that the Satan turned himself into a river. And Avram went into the river and he felt like he was going to drown in that river. The water came up to his nose. And he kept going. And at the point where the water came up to his nose and he still forged ahead, the water disappeared because it was never there in the first place. So anything which holds us back from doing something good is really just an illusion. It's the temptress, the harlot, trying to do her thing. But as we push through and overcome the obstacle, the harlot says, okay, my job is done, and disappears.
That's not an absence of illusion, absence of light, that I'm saying, because she's really there. So it's not like the darkness
No, she's not really there. Really there would be she believes in her cause. She doesn't believe in her cause. She's not really there. She's just been employed to create an illusion of something enticing, but she's not really herself intrinsically somebody who wants to entice. That's the whole point. So darkness is not an entity.
Because you're not going to succumb, therefore she's not there.
Once the prince shows kadosh, like kadosh, yeah, by refusing, yeah, and she, yeah, disappears.
That's right. Did I shed some light onto the yaw? Alright.
You know, there's a Gemara that says, in the famous Gemara, well, Adam better off being created or not.
Yes.
And the Maskana is, no.
Yeah.
Why?
Because
you're going to commit a vice and you're going to be shocking. You're going to be a bad boy. You're better off saying to Kedusha above.
Because it's a gamble to be born. It's a risk. It's a big gamble.
And the probability is you'll go into the Avera side.
Right, it's not a good, that's what a gamble is. The gamble, yeah, always, yeah, the probabilities, well, are in favor of the house, right?
That's right. So
it's a gamble. Being born is a gamble.
Are you, when you're born, are you naturally pristine, and therefore you're going to be naturally good or bad? You'll have to say the Gemara came from Maskana, you're naturally going to fall.
No, that's not the Maskana, yeah, of the Gemara. Yeah. Look carefully at the words. It's not the Maskana. The Maskana of the Gemara is
you better not be born.
You're probably going to succumb.
So therefore you better.
But that's not your...
Correct. Not guaranteed. Of course not guaranteed.
But that's not your default.
No, no. Well,
your default, yeah, is good.
No, default is...
But the...
Where you start. Temptation, where you start is good.
No, where you start is good.
That's not neutral. A default.
No, your default is neutral.
Sorry, where you start is good. Where you start is good.
No, you start neutral.
You start good.
You haven't done any mischief at all anymore.
Doesn't matter. You have purity. Your neshama is pure.
Okay, so you haven't done anything with it though.
Correct.
So, and despite having...
You haven't had any opportunity to do anything.
That's right. Yeah, 100%. So despite having all the likelihood to have the neshama, everything to push you to the good side, mm-hmm, more than likely you'll commit a virus and you'll go negative.
That's true,
side.
But that doesn't mean...
So therefore...
If you have a white...
Natural good or bad, you say the natural tendency is to go to the left.
If you have a beautiful white garment, a white shirt, which is, you know, yeah, shiny and clean and brand new... the likelihood is that just walking around is going to get dirty. That's the likelihood. But its starting point is that it's white and clean.
That's right. So if you're wearing a white shirt and you, yeah, have to return it, your mother dresses you in the morning in a white shirt and you have to return your wife, whatever it is, mm-hmm, and you have to come back at night in, mm-hmm, a perfectly white shirt, mm-hmm, are you better off walking through the mud in the jungle and the forest, or are you better off not walking through the jungle and the forest?
That's what the Gemara says. Don't
say
walk.
Better off not, because chances
are not.
No,
but the Gemara is not saying that it's not a white shirt.
No. Yeah,
okay, that's
not
my point.
It's not good or bad. It's not a good shirt. It's a white shirt. It's
no, clean is white. Good. It's a clean shirt. And you could go through the forest and keep the shirt clean.
You could. But
likelihood is going to get dirty.
Right. So you're better off not going through there.
Better off not going through the forest. Because you run the risk, the gamble,
right,
of messing up something which starts off clean.
Which means you'll come back a naughty boy. You've got a dirty shirt.
Correct. In the end analysis. Mm-hmm. But my point was that you start off with a clean shirt. You start off good.
Okay,
you start off actually good.
You haven't had a chance to dirty it up yet.
Correct, but your starting position is good. Doesn't matter. Your starting position is clean.
So are you likely to ruin it or not? Yes, you are.
That's what the Gemara says. Yeah. You're likely to ruin it. But
so you're likely to be a naughty boy.
You are likely to end up with a dirty shirt. Yes. You'll end up with a dirty shirt. Yeah, I agree. So we're not arguing.
It seems to give you a little indication that generally people are likely to sin.
It doesn't seem that way.
You should know that
Darcy Yachty
opposes that because
Rabshim Bayachai. Yes, that's true, yes.
That's right. So that's why many people say, like Boim, but they chose him. It's because it's really a celebration of mankind.
Exactly.
That we're celebrating.
You know, what's fascinating to me, I mean, on that point, in Israel there's an awful division between the religious and the left and the right. I mean, there's all these labels and divisions and things that divide and just you could easily grow up your whole life in Israel and not have any exposure to a religious community, or if you're in a religious community, to a secular community. It's like two worlds right next to each other in physically close proximity, but parallel universes, totally not the same. In fact, there are many, many, many Israelis who say that their only Jewish experience ever, including Yom Kippur, including everything, because Yom Kippur is a day to go to the beach, right? What's that? In Israel.
I say Israel, when they come to Chutz Laaretz,
they become religious, but yeah.
Not all, but they experience at least.
They do, yeah. But in Israel, they you know, they say the only Jewish thing that they've ever done in their life is Lag B'Omer. Lag B'Omer is the one Jewish thing that every Israeli does. It's they have these parades, and religious people come, and the non-religious, everybody comes. The labels fall away on this day. And it's interesting because, you know, the students of Rabbi Akiva passed away because they didn't show each other respect. And they stopped dying on Lag B'Omer. In other words, they showed each other respect on Lag B'Omer. And Lag B'Omer is the day when all the labels fall away. What?
Well, they all die.
Well, they're all dead at that point in time. Five left, yeah. They stopped dying on Lag B'Omer. That's how they got there. Anyway, so it should be Taka, bring about peace and unity and light to chase away the darkness.
Yeah, it's not a religious event, like, per se. There's no mitzvah say yoyin, there's nothing there that you have to do. Certainly no loisha, so there's no asha, there's nothing.
There's nothing, just simcha. Yeah, well, they're getting together and they learned some Torah and they...
I'm not going to say now, secularist. It's a nationalist holiday.
The Chabad has, in Israel, almost every single Israeli child attends a Lag B'Omer parade on Israel. It's unbelievable. And at those parades, you have twirly-whirlies, people with long payers, and you have other people, and they all are united in, I don't know, bonfire building, whatever it is, but they all united for that moment.
And I also say that the non-Jewish Israelis have no connection to Yiddishkeit. It's very hard in Israel to do that because they see Pesach on TV, every advertisement, they know it's coming on. They see Matzah in the street. You can't be totally removed from it. They know it's Yom Tov, they know it's Rosh Hashanah. So they know that Yom Tov's coming.
I have
living
a group...
In Eretz Yisrael, you can't say you have less influence at Yom Tov around you than in Chutz Laaretz. Living in the middle, forget Melbourne, living in Geelong or some city in the middle of Melbourne.
Yeah. No, I lived in Israel for 3 years. And I did not know it was Christmas for 3 years. I had no clue because it's totally not advertised at all.
Yeah. But you can't escape Pesach or Rosh Hashanah.
You can't escape Pesach or Rosh Hashanah.
It's like saying living in Melbourne not knowing it's Christmas. It's impossible.
Correct. You can't be in Melbourne not know it's Christmas,
yeah,
right?
Every Jewish boy knows it's Christmas.
Exactly. But you don't know it as a religious...
You don't have to go to church, you don't have to do anything like that, but you know it's happening there.
Yeah.
So to say that, you know, in Israel...
But they don't participate. Participate in any religious event. They don't go to shul ever. I mean, you know, many Israelis have never been into a shul, but they've all been to Lag B'Omer parade. It's interesting. It has a schus that it's a unifying force in Jewry, no matter what, you know. And everybody, there's no, the religious do it, and the sorry, I hate saying the word secular about Jews, but those who are not ostensibly observant do it as well. And
inoffensive.
What?
It's inoffensive.
To what?
To attend a parade. So it's not like you can't be against it for any particular reason.
Well, but there are other things that I thought would be inoffensive and people, they'd make it very controversial.
Is there mincha now?
There is mincha.